There's an argument among Bitcoiners that Bitcoin can be the thing that eventually makes real estate more affordable. It's a complicated idea to unpack, and our guest today has joined us for a scintillating dive into the relationship between Bitcoin and real estate. Tom Carrazza is co-founder of Rockstar Real Estate and someone who has made a unique journey transitioning from being real estate only to helping his real estate investor clients think about incorporating Bitcoin into their investment portfolios. I'm Scott Dietels. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. So if you're interested to learn something about how Bitcoin could make real estate more affordable for everyone, stick around. This is one of my favorite topics. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. We are joined this week by guest, fellow Canadian Bitcoiner, real estate mogul.
Oh, geez.
Tom Carrazza.
I don't know about that, but sure. Yes, thank you, Scott. Honor to be here and just to get to know you better and do this. Love it. So thank you.
I appreciate you coming on. You know, we share in common a love of two topics. One of them is monetary debasement, and the other is the hyperfinancialization of real estate, which should give our listeners some idea of where this conversation is going to go today. Maybe before we start, just a quick TLDR introduction of yourself for our listeners.
Sure. Yeah. Born just on west side of Toronto, went to school, did all the right things, went to university, got a degree, got the quote unquote good job, went into tech. I was at Oracle from 98 until about 2005. Then I went to NetSuite, which went public on the New York Stock Exchange for $1 billion, 6 months before it went public. I said, I'm out of here. I was buying real estate with my brother, rental properties around McMaster University. And these things started spitting off cash flow and were going up in value. And I couldn't reconcile, like, why am I starting to get more net worth from these properties than like this high paying, quote unquote, high paying tech job? And I couldn't, my brain couldn't handle it anymore, I think, Scott. And I just quit my job to start Rockstar Real Estate with my brother to help other Canadians put, you know, productive assets into their lives, because nobody was helping back then, the mom and pop real estate investors. As crazy as that sounds now, in 2006-07, nobody was helping investors. Like, investors were the enemy to most people in the real estate industry. So we started Rockstar Real Estate, and now we have a team of 60 people. And you know, through Rockstar, there's been literally billions of dollars in rental properties bought, all across Ontario. And we have wonderful clients that we've worked with and a wonderful team. And we have this bigger message called Your Life, Your Terms. We're not buying real estate to own real estate. We're trying to live our life on our own terms and using real estate as a vehicle to get there. And yeah, that's kind of been, and then I stumbled into Bitcoin and then I met you. So that's how, that's how we got here. That's how we ended up here. But real estate, to me, was the thing. Like, that was the thing that I couldn't figure out why these rental property. Like, I remember sitting down with a spreadsheet at NetSuite before I quit with another regional sales manager. I was classic middle management, and I was running these numbers in the spreadsheet, and I was looking at this. He was an accountant, and I remember saying, like, I don't get this. Like, this looks like it's going to get me ahead financially faster than like this job I'm working at. I don't understand. You know, I don't get it. And he was trying to look at the opportunity costs and all these complex terms and the risk. And I was just boiling it down to, like, here's the income, here's the expenses with leverage, here's my rate of return. I have to go down this path. Like, this seems like the way. Little did I know Bitcoin would be burst, you know, a short time after. And if I had just picked up some Bitcoin in 2011, maybe I would have spared myself a lot of real estate pain over the last few years. But yeah, real estate just opened my eyes to, like, this whole idea of go to school, get good job, as we all know now, is just this weird tale that we tend to propagate through generations at this point. And it's leading to me as to a society that is slightly angry, has unconscious angst, doesn't understand why they feel frustrated, is pointing fingers at each other to place blame. And it all boils down to a monetary system that is rewarding asset holders, as you know, and is kind of robbing savers and income earners. So yeah, to me, it kind of gets wild, but Bitcoin presents this whole new opportunity of hope, which is really cool. And I think it'll fix the real estate market.
And that's where we're going to go. I think it's such an interesting, so we did an episode with Taylor Sugar very early in the show about a year ago, who's a realtor in Ontario, talking about sort of the, you know, what is the basis of the argument, or how could real estate investors think about Bitcoin? For those listening, if they want to check that one out, this could be good. I think that real estate, there are a few problems that are difficult to unpack. One is, you know, it's something that is an obvious thing that people want to own. And over time, that has sort of mutated into, it's become a core part of people's financial planning and retirement planning. And then from there, it has become an enormous financial asset class. So all of these things are kind of interrelated. There's a built-in demand because people need to live somewhere. And that thing, that demand makes it attractive for other people to want more of that thing. And then we have this more nebulous problem of the continual creation of more and more money, which is something that you're one of the best charters of this. And if there are people who are on Twitter, Tom is always posting great infographics and visuals about the rate at which the Canadian dollar is being debased.
That's me waving my fist at the sky. That's the old guy waving his fist at the sky. That's what's happening there.
Yeah. So maybe just to spell it out, the general premise is kind of like, and you can compare real estate prices with the expansion of the money supply. And it's a very informative way to look at how much of just new money created is being I'm soaked up into real estate and what that's doing to push prices farther and farther out of reach for normal people. How does Bitcoin, maybe firstly, you know, when you understood Bitcoin, what did that do for your understanding of real estate as an investment?
Yeah. Okay. So this is a big question. Just to take one step back on the real estate front, for a lot of my personal friends and for anyone listening to this, the reason real estate prices act the way they do is because we're in a debt-based monetary system, money comes into this system as debt. Mortgages, when you or I sign the piece of paper to create a new mortgage, is creating an absolutely extreme amount of new money that goes to real estate first. So real estate prices are then rewarded because all of that new money hits real estate first, and then it filters out to contractors. If you own a real estate, you're hiring usually contractors, filters out to other things. But when you're an income earner, you're not putting pen to paper to magically create new monetary units. So you're not getting the benefit of the new money first. But when that new money comes into the system through real estate, it's debasing all the monetary units that exist already. So if you're earning an income and a bunch of people are buying real estate, your income is getting debased at the rate at which new monetary units are created from all the people purchasing real estate, getting these new mortgages, having these monetary units hitting the economy. So like real estate just happens to get rewarded so well in this system because it's first in line to get the new monetary units. It's not like real estate is anything magical. In fact, without the leverage that the banking system in Canada offers you to buy real estate as an investor, there's no magic to it at all. It only goes up at about 7% compounded a year, the same rate that M2 money supply in Canada goes up. Like, it's really not getting you ahead. It's only the fact that you can leverage it at the bank, and Canadian banks will accept it as collateral, where you can put 20% down. If it goes up on average 7% a year, then that's a 35% return on your 20% annually. So that kind of just draws a lot of interest into it. People might not be thinking of it that way, but that is really what's happening. So sorry, I kind of went on a little bit of a tangent there.
No, and then so that creates sort of a feedback loop where higher prices attract more investment and then more money expansion, which leads to higher prices, which attracts more investment.
And then if you're a real estate holder, you can go to the bank and say, well, I bought this property at $500,000. It's now worth $800,000. Will you give me a credit line so I can access the $300,000 in, you know, new value? And they will. So then you can go grab another $100,000, which you've then created out of thin air, and go buy a car or go on vacation and do all these weird and wonderful things. You're getting the benefit of first access to new money, which you created by getting that credit line that didn't exist. It's like the bank didn't have that $100,000 sitting in the bank before you created that credit line. They created that out of thin air when you asked for the credit. And people will argue with me all the time about this point. They're like, well, no, really, it's not the way you're describing. And I'm like, well, you're just midwitting it here. Like, that is what's happening. There's just new monetary units being created when you create a new credit line. Like, we can go into all the intricacies of how the banking system works and debate this back and forth. But the bottom line is this is happening. So real estate has been a bit of a cheat code, quite frankly, to get ahead of the debasement. And it's been wrong. It shouldn't be this way. to your point, we're all trained to think real estate is quote unquote a good investment. We built a business helping people do this. And I think to get to your point about Bitcoin, I dismissed it early on as ludicrous. You know, I remember in 2016, 17, someone telling me about it. And I said, oh, well, we'll create the Rockstar coin. I go, how about that? We'll create the rock. Oh, Bitcoin's great. Okay. I'll never forget telling Nick, I'm like, hey, Nick, you know, why don't we create the Rockstar coin? You know, Bitcoin's so amazing. We'll create. And I didn't understand the first thing about Bitcoin, but I understood gold and I understood real estate. So now looking back, like I'm completely embarrassed that that's the way I behaved. I mean, it's horrible. And in 2020, I had some time, as we all did during the pandemic, and I went down the rabbit hole, as many of us did in that era. And I had my holy shit moment. You know, like I remember, I'll never forget, Scott, I was sitting in the corner of the office and it all came and hit me. And I ran to my brother's office around the corner here. And I said, oh my gosh, I screwed us. I was so wrong. We have to buy some Bitcoin. We have to do it now. And then what happens, like happens to everyone, I think I got my first little bit of Bitcoin and I thought I was done. I was like, okay, you know what? I have some allocation to Bitcoin. You have that deep breath moment. And then you study more, you think about it more, and you realize, I don't nearly have enough. I don't have close to enough. I think my whole life needs to be put into this thing. You know, you have like, you go through this like whole process. But I think to get back to your question that you started with, I think what Bitcoin did for me is that real estate is just a scarce asset. Banks happen to use it as collateral. It's scarcer than the monetary units. So, you know, when measured in Canadian dollars, it goes, you know, quote unquote, up in value, up in dollar price. And when I understood that Bitcoin had a finite amount and it was a network as well as a digital scarce asset, it then made me write down what all the characteristics that I appreciated about real estate were, what all the characteristics I appreciated about gold were. And as I started to go through the list, Bitcoin started beating those things on every category. And that made me realize that I was staring at something that was very different and that maybe in my lifetime, I've never seen before. And, you know, if you look at gold and real estate, some of the characteristics of both of those things, a Bitcoin kind of beats them in many, many, many levels. And once I understood that, that made me just kind of decide that I needed to add this to my own life and do it pretty quickly. So I don't know if I'm answering your question there, Scott, or not, but that was kind of the process.
You know, and then this has kind of been my opinion about real estate and Bitcoin is this idea that most of what people are trying to do, not all, but a lot of what happens in investing in real estate is just trying to get the thing that is going up faster than the other things. And this is where real estate, in my mind, runs into a problem with Bitcoin, because if there is something that goes up faster and is simpler and requires less work, then that thing is going to eventually sponge up some of the capital that is currently flowing into the way that people have understood is the easiest way.
And we're starting to see it now. Like we see some clients selling some real estate properties to purchase Bitcoin. So like we're on the front lines, which is weird in this business. Like I feel like we had the revolving door of seeing everyone run into real estate. Right. And now the door has started. It's not a huge run to sell real estate to Bitcoin, but I can tell you 3 years ago, I never saw it. And now I can tell you that I have seen some clients and some members of our own team sell real estate to make sure they have some Bitcoin allocation. So I have seen the reverse trend begin. I don't think it's a rush for the doors yet, but as people start to understand what Bitcoin is and compare it to real estate, I think we're going to see that trend continue. And the reason that I think Bitcoin can fix housing is the real estate has become so financialized because of what you said, everybody rushing into it and the banks eagerly lending against it, that the price of real estate has gone up to the point where it's increased so much more than incomes have increased that it's made it unaffordable for Canadians and people around the world to own. I mean, I have the same real estate conversation with some of my extended family in Italy. When they're trying to buy real estate, they're having the same conversations. You know, if you're in an area of Italy that's urban, the prices of the real estate compared to the incomes just aren't the same. So this is like a problem all throughout the global or through the West, at least. What Bitcoin can do is if Bitcoin demonetizes things like real estate, it'll put the dollar price of real estate back to a much more affordable place. So real estate can return to its proper utility value. And when real estate returns to its utility value, not only does it make it more affordable for the average Canadian to buy it, which to me is a good thing, or to rent it, which to me is a good thing, it introduces a much more sophisticated investor into that space. Because if you can't just make money by buying real estate and holding it, hoping to flip it for a higher price, you're forced to develop properties that are really valued by the community and that people will pay for because it's not going up at an artificially high price. So the investor or the developer now must introduce product to the community that is really high quality, is really serving the needs of what people want, so that people will separate themselves from their money to buy it. Whereas so far in the Toronto area and right throughout Canada, there hasn't been that need. A developer could almost throw up anything. You make a box in the sky that's kind of boring and people are going to buy it because it's been financialized to this point. So the return to utility value, I think a lot of real estate investors misunderstand that they think it's like a negative. They're like, oh my gosh, real estate. And I'm like, no, like it's an actual positive. Banks are probably still going to lend against it and there'll still be some capital markets that support it and all that wonderful stuff, but it's just going to produce a better product and that better product will be also more affordable for people. So then you have a society and a community that really has access to housing, whether they want to rent or buy at much better prices. And that's the kind of world I want to live in. And I think without Bitcoin, that wasn't even a possibility in my lifetime. But with Bitcoin, I can see it at least as a possibility in my lifetime. I'm hoping sooner than later. But before, I never could see that.
If there's a better and simpler solution to the number go up problem, then most people are going to want to just own the amount of real estate that either makes sense for them or, you know, that they can afford as a luxury, like if people have a cottage property or whatever on the side, kind of the way things were 50 years ago before this kind of like financialization process had really, you know, matured, I guess, to the point where it is now. So I think that makes total sense. And I hadn't thought about what your secondary effect there of sort of changing the market dynamics of the kinds of investors and opportunities that will exist in real estate. Because I agree with you completely. Real estate's not going to zero. You know, there is this sort of built-in permanent demand because people need to live in this stuff. So yeah, I think that's a really interesting point around sort of maybe reintroducing actual free market dynamics into this thing. And you know, this is one of the trickiest parts of the real estate problem is it is a giant Ponzi scheme that many people are trapped in. And so the problem of unwinding Ponzi's is hard because, you know, politically, even decisions that could help most people are going to be really unpopular for the people who are unable to divorce the difference between being a person who needs somewhere to live and a real estate investor. Like this kind of just played out in Kelowna over the last year where the province went really hard at Airbnbs and Kelowna had been a really Airbnb heavy market, like something like 4,000 listings in a community that's not very big. And, you know, the investors on that side felt quite rugged, rightly so, because, you know, they had bought these condos thinking that they were going to have, you know, X rate of return, all these things. But at the same time, like there is a direct impact on when, if real estate starts getting used for other stuff too, like it's a complicated problem.
Yeah. When you centrally manage such a complex part of the market, you are just going to get manipulations in different areas that are not fair to anyone. So the people who bought those Airbnbs, like some of them I'm sure some of those people who bought those Airbnbs are teachers, some are nurses, some are like, they're just great, wonderful people, let's face it. But they were forced into buying real estate because they maybe got an inheritance, maybe they were able to save a little money. And then what does everybody do? They panic because they know, whether they can articulate it or not, they know that they can't hold the money just as cash Canadian dollars. So they're either then forced to invest it into the stock market or forced to do something in real estate. None of them want to. No, nobody really wants to do this. Nobody's really dreaming of becoming an Airbnb host, let's face it. But they're forced into this segment of the market through a manipulated, complex system where some central figure called our Bank of Canada decides what interest rates are going to be that dictates the price of money. And then another layer of regulatory nonsense is implemented there when you have the city that allowed Airbnbs but then doesn't allow them. So you have all these people who are then, they're literally trapped into a corner. They have some savings or some money by some hard work, some value they've presented to the economy. In exchange, they've received some money. They've managed to save it. Then they want to protect the purchasing power and they turn to real estate to do it. And then they're rugged with interest rate changes or with Airbnb regulation changes. it's what makes me crazy about our society. And maybe it's just because, Scott, I'm turning into this like old guy over here, but it just seems like it's all so ridiculous. And the beauty of Bitcoin is that I can now own this one thing where I can take custody and have property ownership directly of this, and I can't be rugged. Where else are you going to find that?
Yeah. You know, prior to the financialization of real estate, another common practice that has really gone the wayside is savings accounts. Like, people really did just used to have money sitting in a savings account that was generating an interest rate return from the bank, which obviously no one can do that anymore. But we really, most, like, to your point, I really feel strongly, most people do not want to have a side hustle being a mini hedge fund. And people aren't meant to have 100% of their retirement savings invested in the market. Like, that's just insane. But you have to, because if your whole portfolio doesn't perform at a 7% return, you're losing money. And so this is, yeah, I love this. You know, this is what Bitcoin offers. It's really an opportunity to just think about parking your money somewhere where this is the next generation of savings account almost.
Yeah. I feel like I need to go around the city with stickers and put little houses on the savings button on all the ATM machines, because all the savings have become houses, right? Like, there's no savings anymore. It's like you buy real estate. Now we get to put little Bitcoin stickers on all those things instead. So it's like a bit more exciting.
Yeah. And this is why people are, you know, nobody wants to stomach the thought of house prices going down, because it's their savings account. And so here, you know, this is that, it's that melding of things that aren't meant to be the same thing, but this is just where we are.
And I love what the way Jeff Booth will explain it, well, which made me think about things a little differently. And your book actually really, I enjoyed, because it, you know, just got me back to thinking about Bitcoin from a completely different angle, was that Jeff talks about productivity gains. Like, we talk about 7% debasement, but we're really missing out on some percentage of productivity gain that we should be getting in the economy. Like, prices shouldn't go up, to his point, when everything's getting more efficient. We have more computers and more technology and we're better at everything. So things should get cheaper. And he uses a number of like 5%. So, like, why are things not getting cheaper by 5%? So if you say they should be getting cheaper, but in fact, they're going up because of debasement at 7%. And I think we're being kind and conservative at 7%. But really, if you add the negative 5 to the 7, it's really now like a 12% hurdle. And that's how Nick and I, my brother and I, operate our lives. We think we need to be beating at minimum 12% to protect our purchasing power, ideally 15% to be safe. And where are you going to try and find to beat that number? And then if you don't have exposure to what Bitcoin is, or you think it's too volatile, or you don't understand it, where do you really turn? You turn to buying, you know, like when I was younger, I bought mining stocks where my friend said, buy this thing at, you know, 20. It's like, it was like the meme stock for like people my age. It was like, you know, you buy this mining stock in Alberta, over the counter. I'll never forget. I'm like, Tom, buy it at 20 cents. I swear it's going to go to 45 next Wednesday or something. And you bought it. And I remember buying like $2,000 worth. And it was all my money at the time. And it would go straight to zero by the next Tuesday or Wednesday. And I did that like 3 or 4 times before realizing, what am I doing? I don't know what I'm doing. And it's the same thing today, but it drives people into the speculative type investing. So when I see people buying meme stocks today or gambling on stuff, I have empathy. Like, I get it. Like, it took me listening to, probably reading your book and listening to people like Jeff Booth, probably like 15 times, to really internalize some of these concepts of like, oh, you know, I should just buy this one thing, and Bitcoin represents this property value. And something else that Bitcoin represents for me, Scott, is that I feel like, and before Bitcoin, I never custody any property of real value in my life. Like, if I had exposure to stocks through my TD or RBC or BMO or whatever online banking account, if shit hits the fan, it's not like I didn't request those shares to be mailed to me. So, like, I'm not custodying the Apple shares. If shit hits the fan, I'm pretty sure they're going to just dump me out to cash. And if they have to liquefy the market, you know, by tripling the monetary base in this country to make sure the banks have enough liquidity for our financial safety, by the time I get my dollars out of that account, it'll probably be like purchasing a third of what it could have purchased, you know, days before this financial crisis hit where they froze everything. So even though I'm buying Apple shares, and I think I'm doing the right thing, Bitcoin's the first thing that made me think, huh, am I really owning those Apple shares? Or do I just have dollar exposure to those Apple shares? And I go, I think I just have dollar exposure. Like, I'm not really, I don't have the shares. Whereas with Bitcoin, I can custody this thing. Shit can hit the fan all around me and I can just kind of stand back and like, not that this is a good thing. I'm not trying to make light of the situation, but I can kind of stand back and just laugh a little bit and say, well, my Bitcoin hasn't changed. I custody it. Real estate, at least I could put my name on the title. I feel like it's a little bit more direct custody, kind of, sort of. Like, it can be taxed and, you know, it's not perfect, but I did enjoy that a little bit more. But Bitcoin's next level. Like, Bitcoin is pure custody where I can remember the keys in my mind and I can walk around the earth as a free soul and have custody to a scarce asset that's the best form of money I've ever seen and just be happy.
Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the key distinguishing features there in that argument between Bitcoin and real estate is, you know, a lot of people would include the assessed value of their property and their net worth when they actually have whatever percentage of, you know, equity that's in the mortgage, or the difference between what they owe and what it's worth today. And really, the bank owns that debt. And so you're including bank debt in your net worth if you feel that's the right way to do it. But everybody does it. You know, this is kind of the way I think that, like, home equity, air quotes, is sort of one of the unfortunate and greatest fallacies that people will, you know, probably find out is not quite as sturdy as we may have believed over time.
I agree. And I think it's changing. Like, I think people are slowly waking up to this idea, and it's hard for a lot of people, but I think they are getting it. And you can use, listen, I mean, real estate still exists. If you're smart about it and you understand how it works, you can still work the system. Like, you can mine your fiat with real estate if you want to. And if you're profitable at it, sweep your savings into Bitcoin and become the little Michael Saylor. You know, you could use real estate. It is just unfortunate to me that it does get financialized, or it has gotten financialized the way it has, because of the burden it puts on the Canadian community as a whole because of the cost of living. It's just this unfortunate thing that's developed. And hopefully Bitcoin is this life raft that, like, we can all kind of tread to a little bit faster. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe one of your things I was thinking about when you were talking about Jeff's thesis and prices coming down, like, the multiples on these prices, you know, so it should be getting cheaper to make a house. And there was a time when our parents were alive where a house would have been, you know, a single digit multiple of your annual income. And now, you know, it's whatever, 30 years, 50 years more, depending on how far under people are having to go and what they could hope to borrow. So that one thing to me is a crushing weight for anyone to try and bear, and while they're also trying to just be, you know, a positive and contributing member of society.
It is changing, though. I'll tell you that, like, when I talked to Leon Vancom, you know, the German real estate developer, I think he was on Preston Pish's podcast explaining how he, you know, his family develops real estate and they started putting Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And what you do either personally or even Tahini's, what Tahini's is doing by putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet, what's happening to that real estate developer, to Leon, if you just look at his business, real estate is getting cheaper for him to develop, because as the Bitcoin encompasses more and more of that business's net worth, and if Bitcoin continues to increase as we all have seen it increase historically, and let's call it at 50% a year compounded annually right now, I know that could change and we don't know the future. It's got a decent track record at this point, but over a four-year cycle, it's about 50%. That business, to Leon, in his world, and I know that's not the whole world, but in his world, real estate is getting cheaper for that corporation in Germany to build, which does present some really cool stuff, because maybe, and this is Leon's words, when I had the opportunity to talk to him recently, and, you know, he was saying, maybe we don't have to go to our tenants and demand more rent like we used to on some of our properties. Maybe we can upkeep the properties with a better roof and produce a better quality product because of the Bitcoin on the balance sheet isn't demanding that we always put the cheapest roof on for the least amount of money with the crappiest workmanship. And so in small little islands, to me, Bitcoin is beginning to have a beautiful impact on our world. And it's like pockets right now. But in Leon's world, it's happening. So to me, that does give me some hope, like, holy shit, like, this burden that all Canadians suffer with these mortgages, it's all bullshit or high rents, horrible. But there's just, like, pockets. And I think it was difficult for me to appreciate this. When you start buying Bitcoin, if you buy $100 worth or 500 or 250 or 1,000, whatever it is, you don't have enough of your everyday expenses denominated in Bitcoin. So you don't really see it. But once you're saving in Bitcoin for a few years, and if you're able to build up a little bit of a nest egg, you realize that, wow, my Bitcoin nest egg is increasing in purchasing power. When I look around at grocery prices or rent, relative to my savings, my Bitcoin, things are getting cheaper. Like stuff is getting cheaper for me. And so if you can kind of get to that place where you can see things in a unit of account way, where Bitcoin starts becoming your unit of account, it really does have almost an impact on you much faster than I thought. Like, we don't have to wait 10 years for the real estate market to like go back to its utility value and for everything to be okay. Like, if people just start saving enough in it now, they can fix their lives within just a few short years.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, and for people who can't see it with real estate, it's like the classic, and these numbers are potentially made up, but it was like a house in BC in 2016 was 600 Bitcoin. And in 2022 is 6 Bitcoin. And, in 2030, it'd be like 0.6 of a Bitcoin. And, you know, so these are like 6-year increments if it continues to hold true. So really what you could do instead is park your money on the train that's moving faster than the other train. Wait, stay on that train for 5 or 6 years and have a house for free as the price of everything else relative to the value of Bitcoin declines.
And something else that it does for me, and your book, I just love the way I know you have multiple. So the Tao of Bitcoin, like I love the way it just made me think about Bitcoin. And I don't know the page or the passage, but I remember walking away from that and was like, wow, like I've always been thinking about debasement as robbing me from my time and labor. And I always think it robbed my parents because my father was a drywaller, ran a drywall company in the 1980s. In the 1990s, our family almost went bankrupt because of the real estate crash from 1990 to 96 in the Greater Toronto Area. Prices went down for 6 years. My father was flipping properties. And guess why he was flipping properties? He was making more money from flipping the properties than he was in his drywall company. So, you know, he was talking about the financialization of real estate. It's been going on forever. And then, you know, interest rates went up 3% in 1 month, Scott. And when they went up 3% in 1 month, real estate prices crashed. He bought a property at $750,000 in 1990. It went down to, we think, about $450,000. Couldn't sell it. We were guessing that would have bankrupted our family. So he rented it out, was losing about $1,000 a month renting it out. So my brother and I lived through that. I had to collect rent. Renter skipped out on us a couple times. I had to report that to our father. I was about 17, you know, acting as a property manager. So some of these, anyone who walks into real estate, I was like, it's a no-brainer. I'm always like, just, you know, you better know what you're doing. But what your book did is like, I always think about my father's time and labor, and he saved a bit of money, and my father's, you know, turning 85 right now. And his savings, when I look at it, I'm like, huh, the time and labor he spent to acquire those dollars that are in his bank account right now are not worth what they were when he exchanged his time and labor for those dollars. And it bothers me. Like, it just, it's like, this is pure highway robbery to me. Like, that's my father's, like, I saw him getting up at 5 a.m., going and working, doing all this stuff. And I always think like, oh, you're just getting robbed through debasement. But your book kind of just lets you think a little bit. And I remember just thinking, oh my gosh, like I never turned it around and thinking, oh, Bitcoin is giving me back my time and giving me back my labor, because Bitcoin is, its purchasing power is increasing at such a rate that if the debasement at 7% stole my time because it's devaluing my time and labor, but if Bitcoin's increasing at this faster rate, oh my God, like, holy shit, Bitcoin is giving me back. In the future, I'm going to be getting back my time and my labor because its purchasing power is going up faster than everything around it. This thing is giving me back the very thing that I had so much angst about losing. Like, it is the perfect ballot. Like, it's just this most wonderful thing. And I think that's what really I had not personally spent enough time thinking about with Bitcoin. And then if I extend a second order effect from that, if somebody like Scott, you, can have more time in the future to think and plan and educate and share your wisdom with a younger generation, like, holy shit, how much better is society and your local community because you have the ability to do that?
Yeah, it's a cascading effect.
It's just like this wonderful cascading effect, whereas right now we have an older generation and population that is trying to clip coupons, save and just trying to make it next month without their retirement earnings running out before they die. Like, that's what they're thinking about. It's literally a horror show to think that that's how life, the last 10, 15, 20 years of your life is all about. Whereas if we reverse that through big saving in Bitcoin, and the last 10 or 20 years becomes this beautiful thing where people as they age can share their wisdom, and we get the benefit of the wise elder returning to our society. I mean, like, talk about the best thing ever. Like, what does that do for the population where we have older people who can care for the community more? Not that they don't care now, but they have the time to just spend with mental relief of worrying about money, to spend those mental cycles giving back into the community with their wisdom, their time, their labor. Like, it's the second order effect of Bitcoin is rather beautiful. So never mind that we get better real estate properties, Scott, from this, but we also get a population of people that really can contribute back to us in a beautiful way. Whereas when I talk to my mother-in-law right now, it's all about, you know, and this is nothing, she's a beautiful lady. This is no fault of hers when I say this, but like the discussion's, you know, always about like how much money is it for to live and what are grocery prices and gas prices and all these things and all these mental cycles, like, wow, like what a way to live, right?
Yeah, and all of the mind space that occupies. And it does the same for young people who either have to spend all that extra time trying to figure out how to be investment gurus or just can't cope with it. You know, like these are the people who get off their shift and get into the car and go on TikTok and record like a I can't do this anymore video. Like, you know, all of that stuff is not okay.
You know, we joke about that with one of the younger guys in here. I'm like, you're such the old Italian guy who bought property around Toronto and you don't know it yet. Cause he, you know, we have these discussions internally. I don't, if he listens to this, he's going to laugh, but I'm not going to say his name. That generation is like, and not him, he's past this, but that generation, that younger generation that you're referring to, they're kind of like bitter about like the boomers and all this kind of stuff. But I want them to pay attention to like, you don't realize. Do you remember, you know, around Toronto, you had a lot of older Italian families now who are very well off because they bought land around Toronto that was farmland. So on the west side of Toronto, there was an area of Mississauga called Erin Mills. When I was a kid, that was farmland. There was cows on there, okay? Like country road and cows. Now it's all developed. We're talking shopping malls and hospitals and condos, highways, like all developed. One of the hospitals has an extension to it, and it's one of these families' names on the extension of the hospital. So they were able to donate back. And if you, you know, if you look at some of this stuff, some of these families, they owned that land on the outskirts of Toronto and they just sat on it. Like they did nothing. I know there's property taxes, so I'm probably like demeaning it a little bit. Like they did more than just sit on it. But like they just kind of sat on that for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And then it went up in value as we're talking about. And then, you know, they had this beautiful savings that they can go and like be rich with, right? And I'm telling him, I'm like, you're shaking your fist at this older generation while you have the farmland right in front of you. It just happens to be the digital farmland. You are the old, this guy happens to be Italian, by the way. That's why I'm using the Italian example. And I'm like, you are the old Italian guy, but you just happen to be in your late 20s. You buy Bitcoin now, you're going to have less problems than the Italian families did having those properties around Toronto. You extrapolate it forward 10, 20, 30 years, and where are you going to be? And what we did is we got out our iPhone calculators and we put in a dollar figure and pick a rate of growth. And we just said, so in that example, we tried a whole bunch from the lowest four-year cycle. Bitcoin's had compound annual growth rate is about like 24% or so. The last 4 years, I think it's to date, it's about 51, 52, 53% compound annual growth rate. So we just picked random compound annual growth rates from 24 to 50 something and just put in a number. And on your iPhone, if you just multiply it by 1 point, whatever the growth rate is, and hit equal like 10 times or 20 times or 30 times, you're going to get the compound number at the end. And his eyes peeled back. And I'm like, yeah, you're shaking your fist at the older generation, not realizing that right in front of you, you have the best opportunity ever. So let's have some joy around the moment that's in front of you right now. And in fact, you're the old Italian guy that the young generation 30 or 40 years around from now is going to shake their fist at saying, I wish we had the opportunity to buy Bitcoin at the price you did, right?
Yeah, I love that analogy. That's really interesting. It's, you know, and it really, I do talk about this. You know, I think it's, we live in this infinite compression of time. So it's getting really difficult for people to think about investment horizons, you know, 30, 40 year planning. It's because, I mean, this is my opinion, but I think When money works well, what that does is provide people certainty for planning for the future. And the worse money works, the less certain the future feels. So that is a, you know, has a negative correlative effect for people's ability to think with a long-term horizon. Yeah. So even retraining people's thought patterns around how Bitcoin works is tough, because most people who are in Bitcoin probably are, you know, and this is my testing the weather based on what you see on Twitter, but like most people in Bitcoin still are really thinking about like what it's going to do over the next year and probably 4 years and maybe to 2034 when there's most of it's mine.
I think you have to get through a first 4 year cycle. Cause like once you've had it for 4 years, I think you then only then, which sounds like forever, but I think only then do you start to kind of get at a deeper level where you're like, oh, like all of this price stuff is just noise. Like it's just noise.
It's going on forever.
It's going
on. On the weekend, I was over for a barbecue at a friend's house and hanging out.
You made someone's life miserable, didn't you?
I've started being invited back to barbecues.
Oh, okay.
It's great.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I was, his landlord popped by just to say hello and sort of meet the groups. He's just moved into this place. And so she is a prolific real estate investor and has a bunch of tenants in the Kelowna area. And asking me, you know, about what I do. And
oh God, they didn't know who they walked into, this poor person.
So she says, you know, she says to me, like, I think firstly, I'm too old to take on that kind of risk. But if I were to think about it, you know, like what kind of annual returns could I expect if I were to invest in some Bitcoin? And I said, well, yeah, you know, these things, 50% is a compound annual growth rate. And you could actually see a tiny fuse in her mind, like explode, because, you know, people working in real estate, like, you know, this woman really does know what she's doing. She's been very successful investing in real estate. But I love to have those opportunities to shake a few apples off of the tree.
Same, you know, it's tough. And like in our business, we obviously work with investors, and I would say it's a single digit amount of our clients who are really internalized it now. And most people are just wondering, why does Tom talk about this so much? You know, like, I don't know, like what is he doing? Why do we have events where it used to be 100% real estate? And now then it was like, I kind of slipped in the word Bitcoin. Then it became 10% Bitcoin. And now like we, you know, Ben Perrin's coming out to our next event to speak to, we're going to do like a live workshop. No, no one might even be asking for this. We're doing it. Just forcing everybody down this path. This is where I get my joy right now, Scott. This is like doing a real estate event and having Bitcoin there and somebody like Ben there. It's weird to see it when people have these light bulb moments. It's really gratifying. Just because I think someone like you, you know, all the second order effects that come from a world where more and more people understand it. So, you know, when you see people have those moments, you just feel, or I do at least, like we're one step closer. Like we're one step closer to a freer, better, more complete, you know, conscious world. And I actually have a question for you. You retweeted this. I hope you don't mind this, Scott. You retweeted this. You said a while ago, you retweeted, what was it? A few days ago. I meet someone, we talk. I explain that 3D space and linear time are illusions created by the perpetual limitations of our five senses. They leave. I meet someone, we talk, I explain, you know, it kind of goes into this like this loop. How has your path evolved? I think I've asked you this before, like, what is it, you know, I know some of your history, but what has got you to this place where you understand your reality the way you do? Like, I'm trying to just, you're like an interesting character. Like what makes you tick? Like, you're trying to figure out how the world works for yourself, for all of us? Like, where is this all coming from?
That's a really interesting and completely unexpected question. When if you could have chosen a tweet to ask about, I would have never guessed that one. Boy, how do I answer that? You know, I think this has been a long road for me of when I first started thinking a lot about Bitcoin, because I had spent my career in the traditional financial system. This happens to a lot of people. So, you know, you can, I think if you start having beliefs that you've held for a long time questioned and you lean into them, it can lead you to start questioning other things. And so I always try to advocate for people who, I think one of the things Bitcoin is the start of the journey and not the end. So for people who are lucky and have figured out Bitcoin earlier than other people, like, don't pat yourself on the back too much is kind of my personal take on it. Like, because there is a lot more, I think, you know, the pyramid, the all-seeing eye pyramid is on the US dollar, staring us right in the face. It's been there the whole time. And in spite of that, nobody noticed it, right? Like these things are like and it's just such a poignant example of the disconnect between things that we take for granted as being true and what may actually be the case. And so, I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of different things that have contributed to, but that's kind of like my Bitcoin journey started me being interested.
So you're curious. You're a curious person.
Yeah. And then, you know, I go there in the third act of my book, and I believe fully that Bitcoin is a part of what people call the Great Awakening. What I think the Great Awakening is something different than I think the term gets thrown around a lot. And so my personal opinion is that we are all living through a exponential explosion of access to information and human connectivity. So social media is so normal now that it's just a day-to-day thing. And we all, you know, probably look at Instagram or Twitter or Facebook like multiple times a day. You and I spent a lot of our lives in a time when that didn't exist. So if you wanted to make plans with somebody, you phoned them. And if you didn't get them on the phone, you know, like maybe they had a pager, or like you'd actually leave them a voicemail, or right? Like that's not that long ago. So we're becoming connected in a different way. And ideas are just moving so much quicker. It's like a cyclone where, you know, it's this thing is becoming, the amount of information's moving is causing more and more people to be able to have these different ideas and share them, which also was not possible. So I think about things like, you know, there was a handful of people who understood Mises and hard money, you know, say in the 90s, gold bugs, who would have got Bitcoin before Bitcoin even existed. But for a lot of people, reading a book like The Bitcoin Standard would have been their first introduction to some of these ideas that were just a lot more niche and hard to come across. And if you kind of like go back even a little bit further, you know, in the 70s, 80s, whatever, I remember my dad when I was a kid, you know, investing was like a hobby that like a handful of dads might have been into. But it was really like, oh, my dad reads the stock section of the newspaper. And, you know, that was in a time where people got their news once a day. It was a one-time event. So people may have interacted with some information once, turned that off, gone to work. You know, you're talking with Sally at the water cooler. You know, it's like, so the pace of information sharing has, to me, is going vertical. And I think we are approaching some kind of an event where, and so Bitcoin is one of these things where I talked about this in my presentation in Montreal. It's called the 99 Monkeys Theory, where it's been observed these were a study about monkeys on an island in Japan. They were, one of them was taught how to wash a sweet potato to make it taste better. And then other monkeys started learning this. And then at a certain point, enough of the monkeys in one community knew it. Monkeys in a completely unrelated community that had no exposure to that information started exhibiting the behavior. There is something much bigger going on. And I think that's actually happening at a human species level. So Bitcoin is one of these things. There are other things. And with the way we think about everything, I think what we're really living through right now is a transformative shift in of consciousness. That was a big segue out of our previous conversation.
No, but I love it, because I think ultimately that's what we're all after at different levels. Like you're thinking at such a deep level, like it's just impressive to me. But the bottom line is everyone's just trying to live their life and be more peaceful and be happy and have some joy and hang out with their family. You're talking about it at a global consciousness level, and Bitcoin's, you know, being at a part of it there. But I think that's what we're all ultimately chasing, whether you know it or not. And some people are doing it in different ways. So I just love the fact that there's people like you out there thinking this way. I listened to this one physicist, I guess it's a couple years ago, talk about how they, you know, you can go down to atoms, or I think it's quarks or whatever it is, smaller. You probably know this better than I do. And I'm not a physicist, so I'm probably speaking out of turn here. But, and then beyond that, they're having difficulty measuring anything smaller. And they're kind of recognizing in physics at this point that, wow, like there's more there. We just don't have the math. Like it's like, you know, it's Newton's equations or Einstein's equations or like whatever we're using mathematically to measure this stuff. We just don't have the math to figure out what we're looking at. But we know enough that there's more there. And to me, it's like, wow, like what is our reality? Like we're all looking at it. We're looking, you know, I'm looking at you on this screen, but I could be looking at you in person. Like what's real and not real? Like what is our physical reality when the best physicists in the world are telling us, well, we can measure stuff, but yeah, like we know there's more there, but we don't even have the tool. It's not like we need a better microscope. Like we just don't really have a clue. You know, so it's kind of like, and the analogy that this one guy was using was that like, it's like you're trying to look at your LED screen on your laptop and trying to analyze what's real, but it's like the microchips and the energy and the hard drive that is actually producing that visualization. So us trying to look at what's real by measuring the LED screen is just like the totally incorrect place to be looking, but we don't have the tools to look beyond that. We don't know how to get to the microchip or to the operating system beyond it and the ones and the zeros. And I'm like, wow, what an, like, we think we're so developed, but we know so little. And so then when I hear you put out stuff on X or Twitter or whatever, you know, around like loosely related to some of these concepts, I just love it because I think you, when you have enough time in your life to think about life, this is ultimately where you end up going, like, what is all this? Like, where are we? What's happening?
Yeah, you know, and this is that, like, I think one of the coolest things that's a result of all these technologies is it is much easier to learn about anything now. And gatekeeping around information has been like, you know, sort of decentralized and people can go down all kinds of rabbit holes. Personally, I think that's a good thing. Maybe the, you know, so the quote that you mentioned specifically is another great example of, I personally think that linear conception of time, the idea that time moves only forward, is one of those things that's like money in the sense that most people assume that that's true. Like the accepted normal is that time moves forward. And my personal opinion is that we experience time. This is like you with the laptop screen, the analogy. We experience it moving forward because this physical experience is a forward moving one where we are born and then we age and it ends. Like the UI, our user interface for the physical experience moves forward. So we experience time in a forward way, but I actually don't believe that that's how it works.
Because you believe there's the physical expression of ourselves as completely separate from our spirit, soul, something else. There's different parts to us. Sorry, Scott. We could wrap this up here. I know this is all, we've gone off on a tangent. I will stop after this. I'll just stop. I'm curious.
Yeah. So there is only the present, right? The past doesn't exist and the future never exists because it's just a continually evolving present moment with an infinite number of potential possible futures that never exist because the moment they become reality, they become the present. And then the moment they pass, they're just memories, right? And so that's just maybe an easy way to think about the difference between we might think of a linear end-to-end events of the things that have happened in our lives and the things that are yet to happen. But the reality is the only thing that ever exists is the present moment now.
Yeah. And then so our ability to think about this present moment, yeah, it's like, yeah, that, and I guess that's where I get stuck. It's like just thinking about that. Yeah, because I can see what you're saying. I get it. You described it quite beautifully there and clearly. It just then, yeah, there's so much more to talk about. We can leave it there.
We'll have to do this again, Tom. I really appreciate you coming on and really sharing some great insights. And I love the work you guys are doing. So thank you again.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me, Scott. And thanks for doing what you're doing and spending the time to educate the way you're educating and share everything that you're doing. And yeah, I really feel grateful to have crossed paths. So yeah, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate this.
Awesome. We'll include like the places for people to find you online in the show notes. And if you're listening and you made it to the end of the show, I want to thank you as well for tuning in. Your attention means so much and hope to see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. BlockRewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.